This is Specific Objects, Talks on Art in the Catskills, and I'm your host, Miriam Atkin. Today I'm delighted to have here with me in the studio the Catskill-based poet Kimberly Alidio. And I will start by reading a short bio to give you a sense of who she is and what she does. Kimberly Alidio is a poet, essayist, historian, and teacher. Recent publications include a critical poetics essay in Efflux Journal, The Girls and a Joke in 1080 Press Newsletter No. 144, Room Tone, Belladonna Chaplet No. 297, and Teeter, winner of the Nightboat Poetry Prize and finalist for the Lambda Literary Award in Lesbian Poetry. She is the author of 3 additional books, and a 5th is forthcoming in fall 2025. She teaches essay writing, critical pedagogy, and postcolonial history for various programs at Bard College, and serves as a mentor for the Poetry Project's Emerge Surface B Fellowship. She lives on Muncie, Mohican, and Lenape lands along the Mahicanatock River, otherwise known as New York's Hudson Valley, and supports collective resistance, collective refusal, and collective flourishing to dismantle settler colonialism everywhere. So I'm thinking that our conversation can be bookended by 2 readings. And we can start off by having you read something recent, and then at the end of the hour, move to some of your forthcoming writing. But first, maybe let the audience know a little bit about what you're reading before diving into the poems.
Sure. It's a delight to be here, Miriam. Thank you for having me.
Yes.
I'm really honored. I love your show already.
Oh, good. My first official fan.
I'm going to read some poems from Teeter. And I'm going to begin with the first poem from, it's like a first poem within a long poem called Hearing. A setting of sun tones says, here's an end of one, the start of another. Off key gets acoustic so a skip can process. The voice a catgut pulled high by creek tide as caterwaul of light in successive waves. Death echo out there in the prehistoric weeds isn't recourse to one's person. An arc pauses before its penumbra, alternating gills of exhaling fern. And this is the last poem in the book from a long poem called Histories. And it's a historiography of arrival at a river. A person gains an epithet glorifying their floral house dress as their whole personality. A chamber piece is introduced as an estranged room, not to be taken for granted and fictionalized. Returning home from the train station, appropriating her aunt's sofa cushion while waiting for tea, gossiping about the poetry conference. Belated renown, who cares for poetry other than late risers, hangs on the hook outside the door. Recited asides break into direct address with a playful gaze. Catalog their names, photo montage, settler colonialism. Cross-reference the timestamps and found recordings with a map and calendar of an itinerary. Measure water level. Interview fishermen, river pilots, rangers, farmers. Cross a bridge whispering, good morning, and see you later. Ways to put a river in time. I get fascinated by these seamless interruptions. Soliloquy breaks for dialogue slipping in published verse. The speaker narrates the scene from within the set, breaking the fourth wall, before returning to reenacting her mundane routines. The script remains stagey, which determines the photography. We started it just because it was expiring from the streaming platform. We didn't end up finishing it. Imagine an entire discipline codifying hungry listening, as Dylan Robinson translates. Sonic temporalities can be another's ambiance. I am on another's timeline. I am on another's originary point, while those from it are in diaspora. The interesting fact is that we all live on it somehow, and as usual, a group or two fail to return favors and act according to their new nicknames. Their mouths. Like all new lovers, I jump into grammars made by others. Modifier, too, For someone so asexual and antisocial, she is her own verb. My butt on the flat stone bank is part of the staging, as is my patient love for her unswimmable waters. The river adapts a stage set of its stuffy parlor, provides the voiceover narration of unremarkable tea with auntie, which I come to realize is both setting for a restless monologue and its subject. This is how I am at the river.
So, to open up a conversation about what you just read, I'd like to turn right away to an essay you wrote about Teeter called On Being Porous, which was published in the April issue of Efflux Journal. The first section of the essay is titled On Magical Worldly Language, and this idea of worldliness feels to me like something that's integral to the piece and to your poetics in general. So I'm wondering if you could speak a bit about what that term means to you.
Yeah, I've been feeling a lot of things away about poetry that I think of what I've been discovering lately, especially in this book, is that you wait long enough and then there's language that comes along sort of on time. You just kind of have to keep a channel open. So one of the things I've been thinking about is, one of the things I'd write about is, how can poetry be something that engages with what we might call ordinary language or non-poetic language, whatever that means to people. But I mean, to me, it means the way people speak. So a kind of spoken utterance in everyday life, which I think I write about has a kind of musicality or a kind of sort of sonic dimensions, which are, you know, we call paralanguage or phatic language, and seems to me like very rich for an idea of language. But usually poetry in the lyrical mode goes about it in a formal prosodic way and kind of has all these maybe devices. And since I'm someone who wasn't really formally trained in poetry until, you know, rather recently, because I got my MFA when I turned 50, I've been sort of curious about going back and forth between the poetic form as people have been talking about it and knowing it, and then a kind of avant-garde, which is sort of like, you know, pushing language. I mean, we're like 100 years into a kind of high modernism avant-garde, which is its own tradition. And people keep thinking about it as like something scary and challenging, but it's kind of everywhere. And then there's the way that we sort of speak in the world when we're trying to exist in it. And those are like three things. And I don't actually necessarily know how they work together. But in thinking of that, I guess I was writing... Everything I've been sort of thinking about and writing has been shaped by what's been happening in Palestine. So in my essay, I was like coming back to Edward Said and his idea of worldliness. And I really like coming back to it, not as a kind of like, here's like a theoretical obligation to talk about, you know, some like concept, but something that felt really real to me. The way that Stephen Sheehy was writing about it in January, and then I was trying to compose this essay, and then to me it's like one of the ways I feel like your thinking actually happens in the world, and so your language does, and then poetics do, and trying to just track that as being something that is not just a concept but something you're practicing.
If you're just tuning in, this is Specific Objects, Talks on Art in the Catskills. I'm your host, Miriam Atkin, and here in the studio with me is Catskill-based poet Kimberly Elidio. It feels almost like a shame that the notion that your thinking happens in the world and that speech is engaged with the world is something that one would have to advocate for. But I think, yeah, I mean, taking thinking seriously as a practice is something that's been institutionalized to the extent that people, even though everyone has access to it and everyone does it, everyone uses language in fascinating and experimental and innovative and imaginative ways, like the act of just being able to take the time to think about that is something that is thought of as reserved for the lucky few, I guess.
Right. Absolutely.
And just to give a bit of biography while also contextualizing Teeter, can you talk about the linguistic environment you grew up in that the book is exploring via poetry? Or I guess another way to say that would be, what was the kind of worldly language that you were immersed in as a young mm-hmm. person?
I think, you know, the title of the essay on being porous is like serious. You know, if you actually want to like use metaphors of like sound making, then I feel like sometimes the body or the self is kind of like a processing filter. Hmm. And in some ways you take in signals and then you sort of just by living with them, then they come out in a different way. If I, let's say, passively took in what I would call heritage languages, my parents speak two languages from the Philippines, Tagalog and Pangasinan, and I grew up passively listening and hearing and not actually being invited to speak or to learn because I was born in the United States and this was not my path to speak those languages. I was just supposed to speak English. Then, you know, then those signals are in me and in my voice. So I mean voice maybe in a literal way like speech, but also the idea of a poetic voice. So that's kind of the basic idea, and this came about, I think, because I was in an MFA program where my sort of gravitating towards language poetry, like in some ways, like startled people, to put it mildly. And so I was invited to, in some ways, write a poetic statement about its relationship. And I think it's been going around, maybe perhaps, you know, a important critique of like the poetic avant-garde as being, you know, white supremacist or being elitist or being something or other. So it was really, you know, I have kind of been obsessed with identity for most of my life as kind of a way to deal with the world. So it was a productive tension to go like, well, what's my language poetry? Why do I like language poetry, in which sort of in some ways the language is doing more sonically or visually than it is semantically? And what's going on, what buzzing is happening in my body and my brain when I'm like reading it? So in my case, I think in some ways engaging with literature, with art, with an interdisciplinary kind of way of thinking helps me bring me back to the kind of very sort of mundane aspects of my life and actually value them. And that might just be me, but I hope it catches on like wildfire, so I have more people to talk to. Like, you know, people who aren't really into the sort of binaries between like, you know, this art, this school of poetry is for this and this is for that. And, you know, doesn't really matter.
Yeah, it's very interesting to me the way in which you're immersed in those speech communities and also outside of them and thinking about them almost anthropologically. Mm-hmm. And so I guess what I want to ask is, what was it like when you first encountered those academic modes of speech? What was that experience like, and what was your thinking about them, your impression of them?
Part of my I'd say my experience has a lot to do with somebody who had a very good job and walked away from it and was not denied, but actually, I mean, I would sort of say, like, lived out my probationary sentence and then slunk away, you know, just like, it was no like huge drama of denial and exclusion. But it had something to do with, I've been trying to write this monograph, scholarly historical monograph, and actually, you know, had a lot of resources, and in some ways I found out that I'm a writer because I just like couldn't write in that genre, in that space. And what's happening, I think my next project is going to be returning to the essay and redefining. In some ways, I would say, instead of actually my trying to deny certain, as you call them, academic speech acts, but trying to remix a lot of them into the more sort of worldly, ordinary spaces. So grabbing a lot of different things that actually, in some ways now, if whether it's like poetry or it's just almost anything that we do, art, you know, it's all like, in some ways, academia. If you also want to include cultural arts organizations as having some foot into academia. So, you know, we now live in a world where we can't really necessarily be outside. And we are, some of them, you know, and some of you feel like we're outside. But in many ways, it's almost like everywhere you turn, you're just going to run into it, mm-hmm. you know, especially like the MFA. So I think it's not really about not being in it, but about always seeing beyond it or underneath it. And this is just kind of an older, you know, fundamental, like, kind of strategy, you know, from Moan and Harney in the Undercommons. Mm-hmm. It's just like you just live with that, being able to imagine or be like, have ties with, you know, whatever you put into the classroom or into your writing or into syllabi is actually not for the institution, it's for your life, you know, that runs through it and around it. And really, it's really just, in some ways, hopefully that'll mesh, and sometimes it will not. But you bring up anthropology, and I think that was really interesting because this is where I'm going to go off a little bit, but I've been really thinking about this term. I've like been obsessed with this movie called Dry Ground Burning, which is from Brazil. Adelie Quiros and Joana Pimentel, I think is her name. And they have this long process.
I think ass is fine.
Okay. This long process of making this movie that with a method they call ethnography of fiction. And I don't really want to, I can just nerd out on that, but essentially they created a living, like, built set, and they kind of work with people to kind of propose characters, propose situations, but those situations will change with the actors that they bring in, and they actually don't work with the professional actors. And it becomes a space of collective memory. So once, you know, over time, the non-actors take ownership of this set, and in many ways, they sort of all start, I guess, having a kind of focused collaborative attention on that space, then they begin the documentary part of it. So they create a fictional space that they then document. And I'm starting to think, well, that's the classroom. You know, everyone's in there. We agree that we play act. Someone's the teacher, someone's a student, people are the students. Maybe academia is like that, like an academic faculty meeting is like that. We're going to agree somebody's playing the chair and somebody's playing like the faculty. Maybe we are doing that now. And in many ways, this film does it in order to activate something that'd be useful for the future, some kind of sense of power, some memory of power, some possibilities of power. And I think in that way, that motivates everything, even my critique of academia or institutions. And that's how, like, I feel like I can enter into those spaces and bring that kind of energy, even if in some ways I'm the only one play acting and I'm the only one documenting. Because I think it really helps me, like, if I'm in a place where I feel like everything's surreal and everything's a little, like, off, to actually just sort of come into that space and then actually take notes, which I'm actually taking notes when I'm documenting the whole situation. And, for example, the way maybe discourse, neoliberal discourse of, you know, education actually, what it sounds like from, you know, living people who are, like, you know, good, nice people, you know, how does, if you just document that just to, like, note it, and then it's just also interesting, you know, not all poetic speech needs to be uplifting in that way. Sometimes it's just setting up a situation and then documenting what happens in that situation. So if I think, enact a kind of, like, I'm going to try to do a criticism, critical, like, criticism, arts criticism, scholarly criticism, that actually I'm play acting that, but I'm actually a poet, and it's like a dense poetics of it. Why not?
Yeah, that's really interesting. You know, like, so many of us that are reliant on academia or other cultural institutions, we have this kind of deep allergy to it, but we rely on them. And I think the way that those relationships get talked about can be this attempt at distancing, which is false. This way in which you can be kind of snarky about the institutions where you work without really changing your conditions, because, so, you know, then the snarkiness becomes necessary, because how else are you going to respond in a situation where you're stuck? And I really like the way this essay, it kind of demonstrates for me another possibility, and the way that it moves between these different registers of language. It feels very honest about, like, where the writing is situated, and also very clear about the fact that it's not situated anywhere in particular. So I think maybe what I'm trying to say is that it's not the kind of thing where the speaker's resistance to something is then completely dominating and constituting who you are, who the speaker is. and I think that's also the kind of anthropological positioning, which is very, it almost has a neutral kind of tone while being critical. And I think that for me as a reader, there's something that's very poetically precise about it.
It comes, I think, you know, one of the things that I've been, this week, teaching, I'm going to call it a language study class, because that's kind of what it really is. And I think I talked a lot about influences, and I think that also is something about being porous. It's being open about being influenced, naming those influences. And I think in not saying that I have to be influenced only by a certain domain or a certain discipline, but actually saying I'm influenced by, like, how many things am I influenced in any given moment to be able to, like, write this language down or have this language come through me. And in many ways, focusing on all the influences, whether they're literary or they're sonic or they're bodily or they're memories or their speculations moves you out of this burden of having to stand for anything, because it's all so shifting. And a lot of it is just sort of tracking all many things, and then in some ways like finding a place where you can collect them but not keep them still, and moving beyond the expected of, I'm a poet, I'm writing poetics, I only have to talk about poetry. So if I talk about sound, I have to talk about, you know, I have to talk about Hugo Ball, or, you know, like that's just the usual thing that we always feel like we have to do. And when we do that, it's like, what, it's for credentials or it's for marking, discourse marking. But what if, again, we're not speaking for or to an institution, but to, in order to just maybe be able to tolerate living in this moment of, you know, immediate beauty and also knowledge of genocide, and also the ways in which language can do something to allow thinking to happen, feeling to happen, existence to be known and sensed, and also to be twisted into all kinds of, you know, just, I'm just like gonna not have a noun for that. And whatever that triggers for many of us who live with intergenerational trauma of genocide, you know, and then it's like, well, then what do I say, and how do I say it, and how do I understand my thinking in that context of this question of what to say, but also what to do, and what can you do? And then it's like allowing your brain and your body to fail, because things are just, this is the moment. It opens up, you know, you can revisit everything that you know, and it all kind of comes up differently. And I guess maybe that is the worldliness of it, and that's the process. So, yeah, just stick with it. So the one thing that I learned in this process of writing that, which maybe is why it's coming out, is that every day that I could write, I just opened up a new document on my laptop, and I just wrote new things like every day, instead of trying to work on this like one piece that was supposed to be, you know, itself contained. So we all know, you know, the journal poem and the kind of Bernadette Mayer kind of like record keeping, but it's like, you know, you just, if you really take it and you practice it as like, especially in your moments of desperation, then, you know, you just stick with it. Like, well, then here we are. I don't know. It does. I love it when you write something and it exceeds you. You know, it's just like, not me. I don't know. It's process. It's just the language of being.
If you're just tuning in, this is Specific Objects, Talks on Art in the Catskills. I'm your host, Miriam Atkin, and here in the studio with me is Catskill-based poet Kimberly Aledio. On the topic of your interdisciplinarity and all the different kinds of craft that you're listening to in your writing, I want to talk a bit about your connection to sonic performance and sound art. Was there an initial encounter with this kind of work that sort of set you on this path of thinking and writing about it deeply? Or is there some piece that feels really pivotal to you, or some artist?
It's so funny. I've talked about this book and I've written about this book so much, and I cannot remember what seems to be basic kind of stories. Like, why, how, do not know. Uh-huh. Like, it's not, again, here's where it's kind of like a little bit funny. It's that, you know, like I had being, I mean, this is also about being in the Hudson Valley, you know, the Catskills. So, but before I moved here, I think I worked with, I don't know how this happened, but I worked with a scholar and sort of noise musician and poet, John Melillo, University of Arizona. Mm-hmm. And I think he just like opened the door. But I think I had been listening to a lot of things for some reason. But so the combination of that, I also was giving I was also invited to give a reading, and the sort of, I did so many Zoom readings in the fall of 2020, and one of them was with Small Press Traffic in the Bay Area, and they put me with Jameson Fitzpatrick and then this musician Danishta Rivero, and it was brilliant because I think just somehow sharing a performance space via Zoom did something to me. I was like, so I don't know whether it had to do with a voice. I don't know if it had to do with sound or what, but it also, so once I, even before I got here, I was very influenced by Leah Bertucci. So like, I love the way she teaches or she talks about her process. Mm. And so I really enjoyed your interview with her. I think I have to say there has to be something about when people do, let's say, non-text art, and then they're able to talk about it using language or write about it. There's something that really interests me in that. How, you know, what comes out of a non-text practice that is then textual to me feels like poetics, because it's sort of a description document of a process, but it's also, you know, it might use all these technical terms, which I like love hearing because it's like another language, and it's everything they know about what a patch is or what a like, you know, I will like remember and then I will forget. But then it's also something about being able, for Leah in particular, to talk about time. And a kind of course being able to do site-specific things, to me, it just feels like poetry, or what poetry does when it works for me. And it isn't just like, well, this is sound and this is language, but, you know, poetry is architectural to me. So, and it has resonances and it has echoes and things. And so, it, maybe it's because it's in a three-dimensional space somehow for me. And so to be able to then bring, okay, well, sound artists are talking in a particular way that makes me feel like I can talk about poetry, then it's just somehow like I'm just going to listen and then somehow make poetry, or like the poetry's already there for me. So there's a lot of quotations of musicians speaking throughout Teeter. Hmm. So, and then being able to meet and have a chance to perform with Leo was, you know, it's also really fun. And being able to just be in a region where like she's continuing to make music and then sometimes try to catch her performance is also just, it's like, okay, well, now I'm living this book. So.
Yeah. And she works with graphic notation.
Yes.
And I mean that, I think that is maybe the most obvious real overlap between what certain poets are doing and certain musicians are doing.
It's fascinating notation.
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of poets that I love that are really treating language in a sculptural way are writing kind of notationally.
Yeah.
I was at a musical performance recently with a writer friend of mine, and we were just sort of lamenting the fact that music always wins out somehow.
I know.
and And yet there was this moment in On Being Porous in which I think that your commitment to poetry as a kind of medium with its own specific powers kind of came through. And maybe I'll read that. So you write, "I would be happy for the book to be experienced as an experimental documentary text or a textual transcription, a transformative mimicry of heritage language, sound, art, and music. But only if somewhere along the way it's read as a book of poems and nothing else. A poem becomes an inclusive, generative field of worldliness." You know, I feel like we always see music as the mode that has the best kind of access to dimensions of experience that are outside of consciousness. Mm-hmm. Does poetry have a different kind of access? Or what kind of access does it have that's specific to it?
I don't know whether I have a good answer to that. I think a lot of people have ready-made answers, or good answers, whichever, if good is ready-made or ready-made is good. But I think I might also, the point I think I was trying to say is that maybe it's also about a kind of social signaling, because I do know when, if you are going to be doing, you know, we all, I think, move across many different media, and sometimes it just happens quite organically, and in some ways we have to call it interdisciplinary, but there really is something interesting that happens across, you know, when the material that you use is different and the processes are different and they all have their own traditions. But I think where is the interdisciplinary part? Is it in a work, or is it in a process, or is it, you know, and how, like, what do we need to build in our world for it to go out there? And actually, maybe more pragmatically, what audiences are we trying to reach, and what communities are we trying to bring together? And, you know, what does that mean? Is that just kind of a celebration of something? So here's where my academic part comes in, that I'm also reading this book by Pamela M. Lee on think tanks and art spaces and the ways in which interdisciplinarity is actually something that may be a Cold War thing, you know, but it's always seen as somewhat positive. So I'm like, my book is interdisciplinary in the point of composition, but not in necessarily needs to actually be understood as anything more than poetry. But I think it's because I want to actually reclaim poetry for being something that can be whatever we want it to be, in a kind of deliberate sort of process way. So, because I don't want language to be taken out of art as and given only to sort of cognitive, rational reference, or that the poetry is a special language of transcendence and the lyrical self and personhood, but is maybe material that is very specific but has sonic elements. So I think I'm resisting the ways in which poetry is conventionally understood as transcendent, and actually saying that maybe the transcendence is in, you know, poetry is from the reading to the reading aloud to the hearing to the, I mean, poetry isn't just going to be the poem. So, but the point I think I wanted to make is to make poets, like, to make our processes actually part of poetry and not just somehow, like, that we get struck by, like, the muse and then we just, like, make this small thing and it's very, like, you know, precious and
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that maybe like the very reason why poetry, and I'm thinking in the classroom situation, can be such a pain to so many students, is also maybe what accounts for what's extra important about it, because it's asking you to temporarily feel sort of shaken out of this relationship to a tool, which is so necessary and ordinary. And you have all these expectations from language and baggage, a lot of baggage around it. And so this presentation of that material as art can be very, I don't know, like annoying to people, you know? It's like, or just to be forced to look at something, language, that's so, that's seen as so utilitarian and ordinary, and just look at it, you know? I think that's, it has, it's, it comes with this special kind of challenge where as music kind of cues, okay, we're in this other place now.
I mean, I think from my point of view, which my experience is that we can take experimental music or sound art, sound installations, all of these composers contemporary to, you know, kind of more like older influences. It teaches us about hearing, about listening, about sound itself, about phenomena, about space, about time. Maybe what I would really like is actually if poets across different, whatever you want to call yourselves, ourselves, we, if we talk about our processes, when we talk about, and we actually have processes of composition, then it can teach us something about language that, you know, we didn't know.
If you're just tuning in, this is Specific Objects, Talks on Art in the Catskills. I'm your host, Miriam Atkin. And here in the studio with me is Catskill-based poet Kimberly Elidio. There's this moment toward the beginning of On Being Porous that feels very important to me. And I'll read out the sentence. In the Western literary canon, a poetic voice is a poet's pure expression of their innermost self. But I am hoping to deflect attention away from my particular social persona and toward the sonic, sounded voice in the worlds of a poem. And so in the essay, you express this interest in exploring a self that isn't discrete and separate, but kind of blended with its environment. There's also this kind of, I guess, protection that having a particular social persona provides. It kind of marks out a territory. And so I'm wondering about the experience of moving away from this. By making yourself porous, is that creating a situation of risk? Like you might be forced to channel or reflect something dangerous or...
Yeah, I think that the question, your question kind of points to the problem of the speaker in a poem as being, even if, you know, again, we're play acting a persona, but it is somewhat attached to the poet in some way or another. And it's just like, I really simply say that, you know, if we think about a poem as something that language enters or kind of moves through, then why does that language have to be from a speaker or one speaker? And, but it could be, just sort of be more kind of mundane about it. If the voices in your head, are they all yours? Like, no, because you're actually maybe playing back some voices that you have heard that you're kind of trying to process. And that is also inside you. So there is actually a kind of responsibility to an authorship of what you want to record of so-called voices that move through the space of you and the poem in composing or in reading it. But risk is, I think I would just sort of have to say that a lot of what I think about in being porous, being kind of is actually being more true or even like documentary about what it means to be post-colonial as like, or a person in diaspora. And actually maybe by being more documentary about the risks that already exist. And that, I mean, this is where, you know, my students were, one of the epigraphs that they were reading this week was John Keane's Manahatta, or John Keane's counter narratives. And one of them was the Audre Lorde, you know, silence will not protect you. And I think in some ways, to try to recover from certain kinds of trauma, or let's say colonial, U.S. colonial English, is not necessarily to develop another self that is going to be separate from any of those things. And part of it is to inventory the privilege that you have if you do speak English, or you know, are able to move across borders, but also to account for the trauma and the pain of all of these things, of having to like constantly try to survive a colonial, post-colonial situation in which you speak a language that is not supposed to be yours, or you live in institutions that are not designed for your flourishing. So the kind of idea of that the risk is already there is something that is difficult to, there's no way I would want to force people to like look into the risks in their lives that they're not prepared to look into. But I think there is something becoming, moving from being a scholar to somebody who makes what I consider to be art is a very powerful thing. It's a very generative thing. You make something out of the materials of the world, including risks and pain and privilege and accountability, and that, you know, not to always be productive about it and having to produce something, but there is a way of assembling something in a new way that just feels like it's more about survival than actually about risk. A different kind of survival.
So as we're approaching the end of the program, I think it makes sense to end with a reading. And so can you say a bit about what you're going to read?
I am going to read a very short excerpt from a long poem that it's colloquially called Dread Poem, because it relates my encounters through artist books and the Manhattan-based Silver Lens show of summer 2023 called Shrines, with particular Filipino and Filipinx artists. I'm going to list them. Maya Cruz Pelaleo, Gina Osterlo, Pokling Anading, Lonnie Maestro, Ryan Villamale, Norberto Roldan, and Stephanie Sayuko. Through encounters with the mystical, ontological invocations in these artists' works, I'm contemplating dread, where the poem is, a concept defined by Kierkegaard, but also a poetics theorized by Benjamin Kreuzling. So, some art in poem form. From Dread Poem. A figure double steps in many gouaches and oils painted by Maya Cruz Pelaleo. Two violins, two flowers, two flaneuses, two become three, a thousand arms, a family of five, waders treading teal waters, one the color of ash shadowed by hanging wild flowers, a gloomy veil of heady honey, a wordless scene for words, Diwata lore alone. This field is where I am waking up now, surely writes necrosis of an opaque watery gouache, the painter's hand making white gauzy on brown figures, gazing at their viewer, looking at images of them posing for cameras. Crescent, cradle, sickle, comma, province, shadowing the lake, waterfall, gorge, holy volcano, province of Maya's mother and my father, two revolutionary novels, secret lanzones, peeled back for six fused, translucent lobes, evolved as such by intervening fingers of the Virgin or an angel, depending on the lore, quenching the Christ child or pilgrim. Popular tales are parties where the divine divides erstwhile smooth flesh, puckering under a hot touch. Black and white snapshot of five relatives at Puxenhan Falls is novel under painter's collage and brush, Sampaguita framing motifs, blossom strewn lake, the tourist resort returns wild, enclave painted for genuflection, garlands, arch of jungle branches, nothing extracted to sell, everyone protected, eternal at rest.
Thanks for that. And this is part of a book that will be coming out this year, is that right?
Next year.
And do you have a title for the book yet?
Traceable Relation.
And just to close, I want to ask about what else you have coming up. Are there any upcoming readings or talks that you want to mention?
Thanks. I'll be reading in Brooklyn at Molasses Books on May 10th, hosted by Ari Braverman, I believe, with Stein on and Austin Wohlers, and maybe another person. And then June 10th in Milwaukee at Woodland Pattern with Stacey Samazic and Lewis Friedman and another poet. And then I'll just be hanging around Hudson Valley, teaching, trying to write, and maybe trying to catch a music show here and there.
There will be plenty.
Looking forward to it.
Well, Kimberly, it was a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks so much for doing this.
It was really, really an honor and a pleasure. So much fun. Thank you so much, Miriam.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Thank you.